Our collective nightmare, a packed New Year's Eve at a ski resort nightclub, ended with the roof and the night both on fire. At least 40 people are dead and 119 hurt after flames tore through the basement of Le Constellation in Crans, Montana. 200 bodies, bodies of people who came to dance and drink and mark another year, were crowded into a place that liked to look glamorous and sound loud. The rest is what happens when the small accidents that always live in the corners of our designs meet the ordinary human urge to party. The likely spark was obvious in the videos everyone already has on their phones. Bottles raised, sparklers stuck to them like stupid crowns, flames reaching up into acoustic panels that were meant to tame the music. The panels burned like they were soaked in fuel. The fire went from a point to a room, to an entire club so fast it turned people into obstacles. In a stampede toward a single narrow stair, young people in their teens and 20s, many with catastrophic burns and inhalation injuries, were crushed in a throat of a doorway where the architecture did what architecture always does when it is asked to hold too many people and too little logic. What happened was not mystical. It was a chain of obvious failures and ordinary human choices. Flammable materials chosen for cheap sound, sparklers used for spectacle, exits that bottlenecked, staff who didn't foresee a flashover that erased any chance of orderly escape. When the fire hit the ceiling, it became an ocean drop. Heat racing sideways, smoke that was itself on fire, and a narrow stairway that turned into a graveyard gate. Videos show people hitting flames with rags, filming on phones, climbing through windows, and outside, others lying motionless. Emergency services raced in, and hospitals across Switzerland and neighboring countries took the burned and the dying. Doctors are moving bodies and fingers and faces through triage while families wait for names on lists, and the state opens the formal business of finding causes. Investigators have interviewed the owners. The legal machinery has begun its slow choreography. The answers sought will be technical, administrative, legal. They will be precise in ways life at the scene was not. This will be called one of the worst tragedies, because that is the phrase civilized societies pick when they want to mourn and move on without changing much. We will study the foam and the sparklers and the stairs. There will be inquiries, regulations suggested, perhaps fines, statements from officials who look like they mean it. Meanwhile, the people who were burned or died will be identified one by one, names added to a ledger that will not hold the weight of the night. The surreal part is only this: we keep building places that amplify sound and hide danger. We fill them with people who want to be seen, and then we light the evening the way we always have, sparkles, bottles, shallow glory, and wait for a ceiling to remember it is combustible. The report will be filed, the memorials will be framed, the lessons will be written into codes that sleep until the next time we want to celebrate without thinking.
Stranger Things ends with a giant spider monster, a Broadway tie-in, and 40 minutes of aftercare that feels like Netflix handing you a participation trophy for emotional labor. First world problem. My fictional trauma came with too many closure scenes. They dropped the finale on New Year's Eve like a cinematic confetti bomb, which is convenient. I was planning to read a book, see a friend, exist for 3 hours, but instead I got a 2-hour-plus therapy session where everyone forgave everyone, proposed on a rooftop, and graduated from high school despite looking like they already have LinkedIn profiles. That age discrepancy, classic first world outrage. If the characters look old enough to have mortgage payments, how exactly are we supposed to take prom seriously? Also, half the season's mythology was parked in a Tony-winning Broadway show. Important plot point discovered in a briefcase? Apparently you needed a theater ticket to access the lore. Imagine previewing your season finale and realizing the screenplay's footnotes are sold separately at intermission. First world problem. I didn't buy a playbill, so the villain's backstory is a premium DLC. The finale borrows from Terminator, borrows from Wicked, borrows from 80s synths and Prince catalogs until your playlist signs a ceasefire. Eleven fakes her death like a musical witch, the Mind Flayer goes Kaiju Spider, and Nancy suddenly becomes Sigourney Weaver with a revolver. It's comforting, and also maddeningly efficient. Everything is resolved because the writers remembered there are only so many minutes in a streaming budget, and even fewer in our attention spans. And can we talk about runtime inflation? You survive an epic monster fight, and then sitcom writers sprint across four graduation speeches. The obvious complaint is too long. The real first world problem is that they wrapped it up too neatly. No cliffhangers, no ambiguous future, no forums full of bad theories to sustain our weekly outrage. Now what will we argue about on message boards at 2 a.m.? So we got a big finale, lots of hugs, and a definitive ending. The true horror, closure. Now I have to find a new thing to be unreasonably upset about.
An 18-year-old in a Charlotte suburb spends a year planning a knife and hammer attack and calls his instructions New Year's Attack 2026. He writes a manifesto, hides weapons under his bed, lists targets Jews, Christians, the LGBTQ community, and writes about turning an encounter with police into martyrdom. He is talking online to someone he thinks is ISIS, that someone is an undercover NYPD agent. He is arrested on New Year's Eve as he leaves a medical facility. The FBI calls the plot very well planned. The rest of us call it another predictable headline. This story has all the comforting beats of late-stage civilization. A lonely, radicalized teenager. Social media as a recruiting ground. A past contact with law enforcement that led to a referral for psychological care, but not long-term prevention. An undercover officer stepping into the role destiny used to play. And a grateful prosecutor promising up to 20 years if convicted. Add a dash of holiday timing, and you've got the seasonal thriller version of Social Breakdown. The choreography is familiar. The FBI first spotted him at 14 after an overseas contact told him to dress in black and hammer people. No charges then. A referral to mental health. A temporary cut of his social feeds. Years later, the feeds come back, pro-ISIS videos return, and the system switches to sting mode. The public learns we narrowly avoided massacre number X. And the press files another short, sharp, sad story about failed prevention and successful surveillance. There is no satisfying moral here, only mechanics. Young people drift into violent ideologies. Mental health systems punt. Social platforms amplify. Law enforcement, when it notices, reacts with undercover operations and arrests that reassure the public without fixing anything. Holiday fireworks are now accompanied by arrests and manifestos. The absurdity is the point. A society that produces lone wolf manifestos and then brackets them with procedural triumphs is not preventing collapse, it is normalizing it.
Based on an article from CNN titled "January's Full Wolf Supermoon and the Quadranted Meteor Shower Will Start Off the New Year." January brings us the Wolf Moon, the first full moon of 2026, and it will be a supermoon. Close, bright, and just a little smug about it. The Old Farmer's Almanac tells us it peaks at 5:03 a.m. Eastern Time Saturday, which means if you like your celestial events before coffee, congratulations. Noah Petro at NASA helpfully notes the difference between a full moon and a supermoon is subtle. You have to be looking to see it, which is either comforting or terrifying, depending on your self-awareness. That brightness is the main plot twist. The wolf moon's reflected sunlight will wash out the quadranted meteor shower. The quadranted's peak in a messy little window, best viewing midnight to dawn Sunday, but with the moon at 100% illumination, the show will be partly an exercise in optimism. Face northeast with the moon at your back, and you might catch 5 meteors an hour, maybe another handful of random ones. Or you may simply experience the rare modern phenomenon of paying expensive attention and being politely ignored by the universe. We name these things because naming is cheaper than control. Wolf Moon comes from Sioux language imagery of wolves running together. Other tribes called it Moon of the Bear or Hard Moon. We give names to full moons, count their phases, and pick beaches and hangout spots to make the event feel meaningful. NASA gently suggests picking a place that means something to you to make it that much more special, which is a nice reminder. The cosmos won't validate your feelings, but you can still wrap them in a sunset filter and call it meaningful. There's also the human patience. Timeline: Artemis II may send a crew around the moon in early February, the first trip beyond near-Earth orbit in more than half a century. Meanwhile, we stare at a bright rock and decide whether to notice meteors. The astronauts might see the far side of the moon, the part we can't from Earth. We, on the other hand, will be squinting through moonlight at a handful of streaks and thinking about how scheduling works when your calendar is measured in eons. The quadrantids will sputter on until January 16th. If you miss them, don't worry. There are a dozen other showers next year with names that sound like they could be cocktails. Lyrids, Perseids, Geminids, plenty of opportunities to be reminded that the sky keeps doing things whether we watch or not. So you can go outside, find a horizon, put the bright moon at your back, and try to catch a meteor. Or you can stay inside and scroll through images of people who did the above and called it transcendence. Either way, the moon will be close enough to matter and distant enough to mock the effort. We will keep naming, scheduling, counting, and hoping. The cosmos will keep being beautifully indifferent.
The President of the United States spent a Friday picking Italian marble and onyx in Florida for a 90,000-square-foot ballroom he plans to graft onto the White House. It reads like a shopping spree for a private club with the nation's front lawn as the dressing room. A project once pitched as a modest addition has swelled into a $500 million personality transplant. Bulldozed East Wing, accelerated timetables, architects turned props. He promises to donate the cost while personally selecting the tiles, as if handing over a credit card erases the public machinery that must grease the build. The marble importer and the contractors are the real beneficiaries of this fever dream. Importers build themselves as specialists in prestige. Guilders and manufacturers queue up to convert civic space into a retail portfolio. Public institutions become marketplaces. Democracy becomes another line item on a ledger. Regulatory safeguards were treated like optional decor. Commissions that used to vet government additions were sidestepped, then hastily reanimated by a court order, only after the East Wing was already flattened. Appoint a loyalist, accelerate the timeline, pretend due process merely slows a brand rollout. The visuals are the point. A gold and white ballroom ripped from Mar-a-Lago, an image meant to dwarf history and swallow criticism. Renderings are shown to allies and foreign leaders like product demos for a monument to one man's taste. Legacy is being manufactured in marble and marketed as patriotism. This is not renovation. It's the privatization of symbolism. The White House is being remade to mirror a private club because prestige is profitable and spectacle is a currency. The optics of personal expense hide a larger transfer. Public space, public authority, and the integrity of oversight being repurposed to service a brand. The law, the press, and public anger become background noise. Important for headlines, but irrelevant to the choreography of extraction. A judge orders consultations. The administration promises hurry. Normal timelines that protect heritage and public interest are compressed to meet a calendar for legacy and fundraising. The grotesque elegance of it matters. Marble and gold are not neutral finishes here. They are the language of accumulation, the shorthand of a system that converts national icons into extensions of private wealth. Every polished slab is a symptom. Institutions hollowed, rules rerouted, common goods turned into exclusive ornaments. What remains is a bleak ledger. A ballroom twice the size of precedent. Citizens inconvenienced by the march of construction and spectacle. Vendors smiling as contracts land. A presidency staging itself as a brand. The country serving as the showroom. The collapse isn't sudden. It's refinished in marble and sold as magnificence.